we're here. This is the Taylor Report. It must be. I can hear myself. CIUT 89.5 FM. We're going to be talking about the death of President Hugo Chavez, oh boy, Chavez of Venezuela, and the impact on the global community. The funeral has and the aftershock of his death has been immense. There leaders from all over the world came, and the people of from all over Venezuela came. It's an amazing phenomena, and there were in demonstrations held here. I should say memorial meetings, discussions, and there's more to come. I'll just say that Thursday, at 4 p.m, I attended a one at Bellwood Park. And I'll just describe it. The Latino-Canadian community in Toronto and other supporters of the Venezuelan people gathered to express their condolences for the passing of Venezuelan President Hugo Rafael Chavez Frias at Trinity Bellwoods Park, a site of a bust of South American liberator Simón Bolívar. And there were speakers there. It was a very impressive occasion. We're hoping to speak soon with Pablo Vivanco, who addressed that meeting, as well as get an evaluation of what took place in South America. But also, I suppose we'll have to say something too about the failure of the governments of Washington and Ottawa to show the appropriate, even you might say, the ordinary protocols of respect for a democratically elected popular leader. I'm beginning to develop a theory that our ruling class has no class. They seem to be vulgar and foolish whenever they get a chance. And whereas, by the way, others who were sort of ideologically aligned showed more regard. For example, the prince, the Juan Carlos, King Juan Carlos' son was there. I mean, that's, you know, I'm going to give him his due. That shows a little class. Phenomenal. At any rate, and I should tell you, a second thing we're going to be doing today is at the halfway point, we're going to talk to Toronto lawyer Chris Black about the developments at the two of the tribunals. He is presently representing an accused at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, and that is General Ndilimana, one of the central figures in the whole story of the events of Rwanda in 1994, which have been turned into films and novels and numbers of books. But Chris Black is one of the people who, because he's had to dig into the details and personalities and represent them in court, has done has command of the story. His client has done quite well in court, and now he's in an appeal stage. And so we're going to ask about that. But also, Chris Black has represented former President Milosevic of former Yugoslavia, and Milosevic died under really odd circumstances. He was in the midst of his trial in the defense stage. He had done a brilliant job of defending himself. And so we need to learn from Chris Black about that, because Chris also was part of the general discussion of how the case had proceeded. It started as one of the most publicized and you might say a classic show trial, because they presumed they were going to be able to easily convict him. But Milosevic provided his defense and was vigorous about it, did an excellent job. But unfortunately, as the case proceeded, he was not in the best of health, and there were problems that developed. And really at a kind of crucial moment in his entire trial, he died. And no one is satisfied, really, with the explanations of how this occurred, because there were a number of doctors, so we're not talking about just any kind of doctor, but major doctors, who were saying, this man is not well, he needs to be cared for. If you want to have your trial, that's fine, but you have to be careful about his health so that this trial will be completed. And so eventually it was, it got to that point where he was forced to go forward despite the medical condition, and he did die. But because the NATO being behind this, NATO powers and others, they really didn't care about, you know, the dotting their I's and crossing their T's in terms of equal protection under the law and an opportunity to represent himself and also to be protected against harm to himself. They wanted their show trial and they wanted it over. And that had a terrible consequence. We are now joined by Pablo Vivanco. Are you there, sir?
Hello. Hello? Hello?
Hello?
Oh, there we go. All right. I'm sorry about that, Pablo. You've been very patient.
No problem.
We saw you Thursday, myself and hundreds of others at the Bellwood Park. It was a early and a really quite touching display of affection and respect for Hugo Chavez, who had only died a couple of days before. Tell us, first of all, why you chose the Bellwood Park and the bust of Bolivar and what you had to say there.
Well, some people may have not probably even noticed that there's a bust of South American liberator, Simon Bolivar. I'd call him El Libertador because he was instrumental in leading the anti-colonial armies during the independence wars from Spain in what's now Colombia, Venezuela, Panama, Bolivia, Ecuador. That's why we chose that site. And obviously why we were doing that there, we were responding to a kind of like an emotional necessity from folks in the Latin American community and other people that have been touched, have been inspired by the Bolivarian Revolution, the sort of alternatives that have been put forward to the sort of destructive individualist capitalism that has been pretty hegemonic over the last 20 years. We were responding to a need to pay homage to an individual in Hugo Chavez who gave his energy ultimately. I mean, the stress of that sort of job, I'm sure, had a big part in deteriorating his health. But we were paying homage to him, providing, giving respect to the individual, but also to the millions of Venezuelans who are going to be continuing that process. Mm-hmm. So myself and other folks, we decided to organize that there along with people from the Venezuelan consulate who we have been working with for a number of years, actually, trying to demystify a lot of the frankly lies and slander that are unfortunately spread in North America, that are fed to the North American public around what happens there. And I mean, unfortunately the previous day or 2 days prior to that, a couple of hours after President Chavez had died, the Canadian government issued a really, really insulting statement that wasn't really a condolence statement at all. It was frankly probably like the most repugnant declaration in of all the world, considering that there was 35 heads of states that attended the funeral from left and the right spectrum. Yes. And I think pretty universally, like, I mean, everyone was just kind of responding emotionally and sending condolences to the family and to the Venezuelan people. The Canadian government statement, our government statement, unfortunately, tried to make some sort of political overtures, again, reiterating those lies around an absence of democracy in Venezuela, a disregard for human rights, all those things which are actually completely false. But, so those are the type of things that we were talking about on that day, Phil.
Yeah. We're speaking to Pablo Vivanco, and one of the organizers of the Bellwoods event. And, of course, there have been so many thousands around the world, really. Hugo Chavez had such... he seemed to capture everyone's imagination and to inspire them. This phenomenon of the Bolivarian aspect... That to me was one of his innovations. I mean, return to the language of Simón Bolívar and to remind others in South America of their sort of common destiny. Can you talk about that phenomena in his outlook?
Yeah, absolutely. Unfortunately, in Latin America, the bust that is actually at Trinity Bellwoods Park, for example, was donated by the municipality of Caracas in 1989. And there's all kinds of busts and monuments to Simón Bolívar all over Latin America. In spite of that, though, a lot of his writing, his thinking, the political ideologies, the ideas around Latin American unity, around building societies of free individuals, societies based on peace and justice. A lot of those things had been abandoned. In Venezuela in 1998, when Chavez was elected, it kind of reignited a lot of that thinking, not only in Venezuela, but obviously spread outwards. And now in Latin America, 14 years later, you have not only the governments that you have in Venezuela, in Ecuador, in Bolivia, in other places, but you have actual concrete institutions which have moved forward the process of Latin American integration, replacing, for example, right now, I think most people predict that within a couple of years, the Organization of American States, which has traditionally been dominated by the U.S. in order to impose its visions and policies in Latin America, is going to be obsolete, because now Latin America prefers to function on its own. They have UNASUR, they have the Community of Latin American Caribbean States, CELAC, on top of the Bolivarian Alternative for the Americas, which is ALBA, which is a regional trade bloc, which operates actually on the principle of trade in solidarity. So goods are trade not necessarily at market price, and the participating countries are not expected to pay for all of it up front. They can pay for part of the trade in other goods. So there's the things that exist now in Latin America before, in the mid-90s, wouldn't have even been thought of. And so that is actually a huge part of the legacy of Hugo Chavez, and something that's going to endure. And, if you looked at the funeral, you'd see that. It wasn't just, the people that perhaps could be expected to be at that funeral, the heads of state from Cuba, Bolivia, and Ecuador. You had the heads of state from Colombia, from Chile, who are not politically aligned with Hugo Chavez, but nonetheless, the political climate in Latin America is so different now than it was then, and in no small part because of the things that have happened that initiated in Venezuela, that even those presidents are feel the pressure in order to and have to pretty much go on side with the what's happening on the ground in the region.
Yeah, it really does. It shows the power of example. We're speaking to Pablo Vivanco, and this matter about this is not just a democracy in the way that apparently Mr. Harper understands democracy, but it's a popular democracy. It has a broad base where people participate. They don't just vote, but I've been told by observers there that people have turned out in larger numbers than at the time of the election. They've turned out for the funeral. It's like another expression of the democratic spirit of that population.
Yeah, like some of the estimates that I've heard is that up to 9 million people attended the funeral. Like all of Caracas was completely paralyzed because of the number of people that were there. But I mean, even what you said is exactly right. Part of what's been happening in Venezuela over the last couple of years, particularly since about 2006, has been a move not only in rhetoric but in actual concrete structures to not only view democracy as something that people do when there's an election. So there's been laws enacted which allow for neighborhood associations, essentially, for people to form their own neighborhood associations and through their associations find out with their neighbors, discuss what they need to do, apply for funds so that they can do them themselves, essentially so that they can govern their own spaces. It's advancing, like, I mean, almost the some of the basic ideas of the French Revolution, right, around democracy as something that people need to be invested in. Some people refer to it as direct democracy or participatory democracy. And in lots of places, like, I mean,
That was an expression Pierre Trudeau used years ago when he wanted to be a popular leader. He said, "I want participatory democracy." It's gone out of the language here.
It's something that's still obviously in academic circles, and occasionally, there's smaller projects or experiments even in North America that have tried to implement these things. Like, you know, some people may have heard of participatory budgets and stuff, for example. Mm-hmm. But not on the scale that is actually being implemented in Venezuela. There's there's about 40,000 communal councils that have that people have self-organized. These aren't things that the government comes in and says, "You got to do this." These are things that their neighbors, if they feel that they want to do this, if they feel that they want to take ownership of their communities, they can do that, and they have in numbers. Like, we're talking that each one of these communal councils represents hundreds of families. Mm-hmm. So, like, I mean, that's what makes those sort of claims that are repeated by Harper not only hurtful because of, like, I mean, the timing of those statements, but also just completely false, right? And it's unfortunate that so many people in Canada, because of the repetition of that sort of slander and lies, mm-hmm. tend to kind of repeat it and tend to internalize that idea that Venezuela, Chavez, dictatorship, when it's actually the exact opposite.
Yeah, and by the way, it's kind of a self-inflicted problem, too, because if they don't know real democracy when they see it, it's Canadians that are worried about their own. We did have a prorogued parliament, as my memory, and we don't have a leader who enjoys the popular support of 60% of the people.
That's the other irony of it, actually.
We ought to look into that kind of democracy.
Proroguing at not only the federal level, but, I mean, we had our own provincial government prorogued recently, right?
Yeah, and curious arrangements, which couldn't happen in Venezuela, where you have a popular participation. They say, no, you can't prorogue it. We don't want you to prorogue it. By the way, that matter, we need to remind everyone that it's also a people's democracy in the sense that that's what saved them from a coup. If they had had simply parties and lawyers and whatnot, President Chavez would have been removed without anybody being able to stop it.
You're absolutely right. In 2002, in April 2002, when there was an attempt to by the elite in the country to overthrow Chavez and dismantle, because it wasn't just about Chavez. Like, the first thing that they did is they suspended the Constitution, they suspended the National Assembly, they suspended the Supreme Court, the Ombudsman. They pretty much threw out the institutions, right? It wasn't just about removing the individual. They actually wanted to halt and reverse the process. And it was the people that went out into the streets that put a halt to it. It wasn't just some sort of political procedural mechanism that brought him back. And so those sort of things that give an indicator. Aside from, like, the things that I've mentioned, and it can't go without saying that the October presidential elections had 80% voter turnout. I don't know any elections in the world where elections aren't mandatory, which they aren't in Venezuela, that you're going to have that sort of turnout. And certainly, like, I mean, in Canada, where we pretty much have been hovering around 50-something percent in all federal elections.
I think the U.S. is below 50%.
Yeah. So
because though they define themselves as a democracy, all the poll takers say that half the population does not trust the process at all and don't participate because they just don't trust it.
Right.
They need to look into their own hearts. Could you tell us, this is Pablo Bivanco, and we're very glad you could join us. These accomplishments, the literacy and employment and transportation, can you talk about those things some?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we certainly don't have enough time on the show to discuss all of the accomplishments that have happened over the last 14 years, and certainly there's still a ways to go. But I mean, it has to be said, Venezuela was declared by UNESCO as a territory free of illiteracy, only the second place in Latin America to be declared that. Through, like, one of the first things that was done was in investments in not only education, but also in healthcare, pretty much in every neighborhood in Caracas. And if anyone has ever been to Caracas, you'll see how difficult it is, like, I mean, to build things in the places where the majority of people live. But they built neighborhood clinics. Healthcare is now fully accessible to the entire population in a way that certainly was never available before.
By the way, can I just ask this? It just occurred to me that their tuition, you can go to straight from grammar school to university without cost, right?
Without cost. That's right. Education was made free and universal through to university education, post-secondary education. And again, this was something that should have been available to Venezuelans for years. Like, I mean, it's not like Venezuela discovered that it had oil in the 90s. Venezuela has been pumping its oil since the turn of the century, and it's like experienced an oil bonanza since at least the 70s, right? But nonetheless, for the vast majority of the history of this country, the people have not been able to share in that wealth. And this is what's happened over the last 14 years, that now they are experiencing, there is a distribution of that wealth. The people are being able to enjoy the fruits of their labor and the resources of their country. And so there's that. You talked about unemployment. Unemployment has been cut in half. It was about 13% in 2001, and now it's under 7, right? Which is, I think, probably less than even what we have in Canada. There's been so many advances in pretty much every area of human and social development, investments in arts and culture. Like, I mean, even I think football fans, the soccer fans, will all of a sudden have realized that Venezuela has a soccer team. That's not in small part, actually, because of the sort of investments that have been made in sports and culture over the last couple of years. So there's virtually no area of Venezuelan society that has not been impacted positively by the Bolivar Revolution.
It is a great story, and it's not surprising based on what you just laid out that President Chavez was so popular in his country and elsewhere. Could you tell us how does it look to you? There's going to have to be an election in 30 days. Those people who made up this great movement behind and with President Chavez, what are their prospects? Talk about that.
Well, right now, a couple days ago, the acting vice president, as per the constitution, the current vice president, Nicolas Maduro, who was previously the foreign minister for a long period of time, he's been put in as president until the elections, which are going to be taking place on April 14th. I think most polling, and if you take into account that there was, I don't know how many millions on the street for the funeral, I do think that most people will be calling Maduro to win again. There was also regional elections in December where the Socialist Party of Venezuela won 22 out of 24 states.
So that's like, very important. It's not just President Chavez; it's his whole movement.
Yeah, absolutely. There are still different factions, and like, I mean, if we had time to talk about the different personalities and what they represent, it would be obviously a bit of a longer conversation. Nonetheless, and particularly in this time, mm-hmm. I think even the leaders within that movement are going to feel the pressure from their base mm-hmm. to unify and to more or less present the united front, particularly at this time. I think generally people in Venezuela are going to be voting for Nicolas Maduro to keep these changes happening, to keep the Bolivar and revolution moving forward. Yeah. There's obviously a lot of things along the way, and I'm not going to be here trying to tell you that the country doesn't experience its own problems. Every country does. Sure. Nonetheless, I think it is pretty clear from the number of people on the streets, from the fact that they've had 15-something national electoral events since 2008, since 1998, and all of them but one have been won by Chavez and the Bolivar movement, mm-hmm. that people have made a decision, and they're going to keep on going forward with that decision, which is that they want to transform their country, that they want to transform their society.
Yeah. Well, by the way, we're going to have to ask you back as these elections get closer to help us analyze it, because it is going to be a very important election, and I think you should be very confident. It's Pablo Vivanco, and it's Avanzada Bolivariana. Am I right?
That's right. Yeah, ours is a campaign of different, kind of like a network of different organizations that have been supporting our brothers and sisters in social movements in Venezuela throughout these years, because, you know, obviously we take inspiration from them, and on some level we take some leadership from them in how we feel that you know, that societies should go. So we stand in solidarity with them, and we also feel that it's our role to break down those myths and the slander that we were talking about earlier around what the media and our politicians say is happening in Venezuela, and try to bring people the truth.
Yeah. Well, it was sure great to see you all there at the bust of Bolivar and in praise of Chavez. That was wonderful. Thank you very, very much for joining us.
Thank you, Phil.
Okay. Bye-bye. Pablo Vivanco. And we'll be talking. We're going to take a little break, and we will come back, and we're going to talk to Chris Black about a number of important matters. And we're back. It's the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. You can check us out, taylor-report.com. By the way, we have on our site today an illustration showing our respect and support for the Democratic Popular Socialist leader, Hugo Chavez. And you can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm. Coming up, we're going to be speaking to Chris Black. I mentioned, by the way, that Phil Conlon is here. We'll have a word from him shortly as well. He has announcements. But now we're joined by Toronto lawyer Christopher Black. Are you there, Chris?
Yes, I am, Phil. How are you doing?
Very well. It's good to be talking to you. You are about to embark on another trip to East Africa. By the way, it's an interesting time to be going. There's just been a very dramatic election in Kenya. And you will be in Arusha, Tanzania, at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. And you're in what is the your client is General Dindili Mana.
Mm-hmm.
He did very well in court, that is to say, you and he.
Right.
But there is yet, I guess there was one or two elements involved in that you had to appeal. Can you talk about that?
Sure. He was, like all the other officers, charged with multiple counts of genocide, war crimes, and individual counts of murder. He had about roughly 60 massacres and murders ascribed to him and his men. All those were he was found not guilty on. The only thing left remaining were two incidents in which it's alleged his men took part in killing of Tutsis at two locations, and that he failed to punish them. On the first one, there is evidence from strong European witnesses that German priests present at the scene that there were none of his men involved, and the second one the same.
Mm-hmm.
So we think we can get rid of that on factual grounds, but the remaining fail to punish charge can't be proved because in the judgment itself, the judge has strangely said he had done everything he could to prevent and punish crimes by his men, and many of them saved Tutsis. So it's sort of an absurd judgment, which we try to get rid of the last parts of.
Just a couple of weeks ago, Chris, on this program, we spoke to the lawyer in Houston who had represented one of the accused in the so-called Government 2 case.
Right, Tom Moran, probably.
Yes, Tom Moran, I'm sorry. It's become rather striking. All of the Government 2 people now have been acquitted. And your client, like them, had terrible multiple charges with the worst kind of label on them, genocide being the worst. And now they've all, every single one of them was acquitted. Two of them in the first trial and then the other two in appeal.
Right.
Tell us about the prosecution theory and what this might reveal.
Well, it's clear that in all the major cases where a government planning, so-called planning of a genocide against the Tutsis was raised, all the accused have been found not guilty of planning any genocide or conspiring to commit genocide. And therefore, in most of the lawyers' views, without a plan by the coalition government in place at the time to kill Tutsis, there was no genocide against Tutsis because the killings were not done by any plan or even systematically. So who did the killings? Who killed who is the question. Mm-hmm. And it comes out to be quite different from what the mass media accepted version is. Mm-hmm. But these cases are very striking, you're right, because if the government of Rwanda is responsible for genocide against its own people, why are they all being found not guilty of that very charge?
Yeah. No, and by the way, listeners should know that General Dindi Limana, who was the in charge of the gendarmerie, the gendarmerie came in for a lot of bad media and all that, but the general actually was understood from the beginning to have been a figure about whom very few people actually believed any of these things, but yet they brought him to trial.
Right.
It was almost like we need characters in a play, and he had that title or something.
Yeah, I think there were two functions his arrest served. One, and the judges accepted this. They in the judgment they say that we alleged his arrest was political, and the judges found it to be so, and said that the prosecution never even denied that he was arrested partly to put pressure on him to testify against Bagosora, the big fish there at the tribunal. And he refused to do so under pressure. He was willing to talk to them, but not, you know, being forced to by being arrested. Well, the second part was he just fit into the logic of the piece, that the whole government structure was involved in committing genocide against its own people. Therefore, the national police must have been involved. Otherwise, the picture doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's why he was arrested.
Yeah. You know, they're sort of like somebody who wanted to make a film and thought of a good title, forgot there was no text.
Right.
and then when they tried to write one, they ran into problems.
Yeah, that was evident from the day one when they laid out the indictment against him.
Well, by the way, one of the things they ran into was his integrity.
Right.
I recall when he was living in Brussels, and he was asked, well, are the certain facts, certain writers were beginning to, you know, writers with big reputations were making generalizations, and he was approached and answered honestly. He said, no, that didn't happen.
Right.
And so he wasn't permitted to be an honest person. They decided, well, we'll have to punish him.
Yes.
And as you say, to coerce him,
right,
which we're all familiar with, by the way, in Western courts. This goes on all the time. That is, we know you didn't do anything, but we're going to claim you did, and if you don't help us out, you'll do time. Incidentally, your client has done a lot of time.
Yeah, like...
based on what?
Exactly. He's been in 13 years for nothing. In fact, he's one of the heroes of what happened in Rwanda on either side, because his forces saved more Tutsis than anybody else, including General Dallaire, who he testified favorably for him at his trial, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
And And they were accused of actually being, by so-called extremists, of being pro-Tutsi and pro-RPF, and his forces saved a lot of Tutsis. He himself saved 37 Tutsis and several Tutsi priests in his own personal house in Kigali,
mm-hmm,
at some risk to himself. Mm-hmm. And yet he was arrested. And I was told when I first got to the tribunal by some very high up officials that everybody knows Mr. Black. Everybody here knows he's not guilty of anything.
Mm-hmm.
So why was he arrested? Well, that's the good question.
There were so many dubious situations. You must be fairly optimistic. I mean, mm-hmm. When does this take place? Am I right? It's going to be in Arusha, you make the argument.
Right. It's the oral argument on the appeal. All the briefs have been filed, so we've been waiting almost a year now for the date for the final oral argument. So it takes place the week of May 6th.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, we're optimistic because his case is so clear,
mm-hmm.
I think.
Mm-hmm.
No reasonable court could ever find him guilty of anything.
Mm-hmm.
But also the appeal chamber has been almost on a roll of acquittals lately. It just acquitted mm-hmm. not only the government people on their appeal, but also General Perisic at the ICTY, who was the Yugoslav Army Chief of Staff.
Mm-hmm.
His case was thrown out on appeal just last week.
I didn't realize that.
Right.
Just past week.
Yes, on the grounds that he had no command and control over the people alleged to be involved in certain incidents, mm-hmm. and also that he had, in fact, not failed to punish those who had committed crimes.
Mm-hmm.
So there was no grounds. So the appeal chamber just threw his charges out,
yeah.
and he's released.
Well, another matter, and we're speaking to Chris Black, a Toronto lawyer, and who's represented accused at the ICTY-ICTR. When we spoke to Tom Moran and other defense counsel, they've begun to discuss this phenomenon. I call it the United Nations Ban Ki-moon Gulag. people who have been acquitted, are still there.
Yep.
They can't leave.
No.
Or they're unable to leave.
Right.
Now, what kind of... Is there some way that the United Nations might be reminded that they too have to respect human rights?
Well, in fact, they have. The United Nations Security Council has, in fact, passed two resolutions demanding or recommending, highly recommending, that the countries in which these men were first arrested and where they were resident with their families take them back now that they've been acquitted. But those countries have not taken them back, principally France and Belgium.
Well, you know,
and then the excuse is, well, if we take them back, it'll cause they stay political or civil unrest. Well, that wouldn't be so because they'd be found not guilty of anything.
Exactly. But also, wouldn't you say to them, but they do claim to be representative democracies.
Right.
And France is one of the great original republics.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that your problem, France? What sort of system are you running?
Well, it seems that they're trying to please General Kagame, because what purpose does it serve for France and Belgium to keep these men out, especially when in the case of General Denis Lamanna, he was well-favored by the Belgian army and certain people in high places in Belgium, for instance, even in France.
Mm-hmm.
And so what's the advantage, except to Kagame doesn't like these people being acquitted.
Mm-hmm.
It breaks up his whole theory of how he took power and why he took power.
Yeah, he has a legend that he's got to maintain.
Right.
If the pieces of that are removed, which you've done in court, you and the general,
mm-hmm.
Then someone might ask him why he isn't on trial.
Exactly. And also, and these men are also a political force. They're all members of the former major party, Revolutionary Party in Rwanda in the 70s and 80s and 90s. Mm-hmm. And they're ministers with some sagacity and wisdom and influence in the Hutu and even in Tutsi communities. So
why wouldn't they be? By the way, some of them, their political stock has to be fairly high amongst the people who know the truth and care about it.
Well, that's probably the fear why they keep them in exile, so these countries don't take them back, so they're stuck in a UN safe house in exile mm-hmm. almost mm-hmm. permanently in Tanzania, so mm-hmm. that they can't do anything there.
Yes.
Which is very convenient.
Yeah, it's interesting how, in a way, it resembles things that went on in other centuries where you remove a guy from a country and don't allow him to come back, except that the nomenclature is such that we talk about United Nations and whatnot. But basically, they're being kept in isolation from their people.
Right.
Of whom they, particularly those who've been acquitted, clearly have every right to be a representative of.
Exactly. Now, yeah, because they're important politicians in their own right and personalities in that community.
Yeah.
And country. And also, it's slightly, I don't know if it is, you can say it's racist, but it has racist tinges to it, because the white prisoners at the ICTY all go back home very easily. But
Well, incidentally, yes. They say the reason that the trial was held in Africa was for, the phrase was, for social and cultural reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Well, are you holding them, an acquitted person, for social cultural reasons? If they are social culture, it must be your social and culture.
Right.
I don't think Africans would agree that an African has no rights if he's been shown to be not guilty of a crime.
Right. And the prisoners, these acquitted men have just written on as a group to the Security Council again, and everybody's willing to listen, complaining, setting out the history.
By the way, I'm going to just say right now, we're going to thank you for sending that to me. We're going to post that on the Taylor Report site. People should read their appeal.
Yeah, it's quite moving and startling because the history is so long and the treatment is so bad of these men.
General Kabilegi, for example, by the way, who was found to be not guilty or to be acquitted because...
Right.
The prosecutor wasn't aware of the fact that he wasn't in the country during the time of the charges.
Yes, exactly.
So, I mean, here's a long, long time in prison.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he applied to the Netherlands and said, my son is a citizen of your country. My wife is there. I'd like to go and join them. And the Netherlands said, why don't you go to Rwanda? Now, the Netherlands sent one of their citizens to go to Rwanda. And she wanted to run for president. She's in prison with her head shaved, wearing a pink costume. You'd think that the Netherlands could answer their own question.
Yes, it's quite clear none of these men can go back to Rwanda. They'd either be arrested or killed.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no way they can go back to their own country, and they can't stay in Tanzania indefinitely.
No, it's like a limbo.
I'm
really glad we're talking about this, because to me, everybody's on trial. When you hold a public trial, the judge is on trial because he has to respect and enforce laws and guarantee equality before the law and representation. And when they don't do that, it's the court that's convicted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's apparent now that the judge is... It's not quite clear why the appeal chamber is making all these acquittals the last few months of the existence of the tribunal, perhaps to buttress its reputation, but... It's a good thing it's happening.
It certainly is. And it's going to take us back into the political realm where we can start talking about who everybody was and what actually did happen, because there are people who they claimed were terrible people, like Kabilegi, who turns out to be was a very decent fellow, but he also wasn't even present.
No.
It's a very important matter I want to make sure I take up with you. You have just written, I believe it's published, an article together with another author on the death of... President Milosevic, at the height of his trial, and it's an excellent article, quite disturbing to read. Is it already available to the media? Can people start looking for it, or is this something that'll be published soon? Or?
Well, it's being published we did it for the anniversary of Milosevic's death, which is March 6th, but it wasn't published till today in Russia on a site called Fonsk, which is quite well read in Eastern Europe and Asia.
Mm-hmm.
And it was supposed to be published in English, but for some reason it hasn't been posted in English on that site or some other sites connected to it. So I've gotten permission to have it published elsewhere in the West in English.
Mm-hmm.
So that will be posted, I hope, in the next couple of days somewhere.
Yeah, well, I'll produce on air. Maybe we could arrange also, we could publish it. This is, now we're speaking to Chris Black, Toronto lawyer, and and you're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM. I've got to remind you that. You're calling for an inquiry into the death of President Milosevic.
Right.
Now, there was an inquiry of some type with a gentleman. Was he a Dr. Parker?
Was one of the ICTY judges, Judge Parker, was commissioned. What happened when he died? Nothing was really done. The Dutch police did a cursory report and filed it. But the Russian, Sergei Lavrov, demanded that there be an investigation into how and why he died. So the ICTY, the Hague Tribunal, appointed Judge Parker to do an internal investigation. So the only ICTY report or official UN report we have on it is called the Parker Report.
Mm-hmm.
And we try to get other information, but we can't get it. We can only get information which is presently published, which is basically the Parker Report.
Mm-hmm.
And if you analyze that report, which I did in my article, there's enough evidence in that report itself, I think, to warrant an investigation for at least criminal negligence by withholding necessary medical treatment. That is, they forced him onto trial knowing it would kill him
mm-hmm.
for their own reasons. And there's some disturbing facts which indicate there's a distinct possibility that there was poison involved or something else.
Yeah. Well, by the way, now apropos of that, I did read the article, and it is very persuasive, and I hope our listeners will be seeing this soon. But you know, in a way, the Parker Report itself cries out for an investigation mm-hmm. because allegations are made there by Judge Parker, which say that, well, you know, maybe the defense was providing medicine
mm-hmm.
which harmed President Milosevic.
Right.
Now, that's very serious. And as you point out, they don't say perhaps someone in the institution itself might have done that.
No.
It's a bias. They wouldn't have any way of knowing if it was improperly introduced. They wouldn't know who. Why point at the defense?
Right.
If you're an investigator, you'd say, let's keep all these possibilities open. But this report actually points at one group.
Right. That started with his arrest when the New York Times, when he was first arrested, the New York Times and other papers put out a series of articles in which they stressed that Milosevic was depressive and depressed and that he was likely to commit suicide. And I remember Ramsey Clark and I and others, and Harold Pinter wrote articles and letters to these editors of the New York Times and so on, stating that was completely untrue and that they were setting him up to be killed.
Mm-hmm.
They were setting the groundwork for that, and that would be the excuse, and we weren't going to put up with it.
Mm-hmm.
So they stopped those articles. But when he dies, they come up with that again, that he tried to kill himself somehow or took the risk of killing himself for no reason that they can explain.
Mm-hmm. Well, and by the way, he did produce an excellent defense. And you, as you point out, John Loughlin has a book, mm-hmm. Travesty,
right.
Which very nicely highlights that defense. Here was somebody, he definitely wanted to live, and he wanted to make his point.
Yes.
Talking about, he asked to be taken to Russia
mm-hmm.
For medical treatment so that he'd be strong enough to continue the trial.
Could right.
Talk yeah. about that?
Yeah, the cardiologist in charge of his case, even the UN doctors all agreed he needed treatment. But the treatment only required his absence for 3 or 4 days to go to, it could be done anywhere, but the Russians offered to do it. And he trusted them to go to Moscow, have a small stent put in one of his arteries. And it would have solved the entire problem, and it could have been done over the weekend, I was told.
Mm-hmm.
And he could have been sent back and then would have been able to complete the trial in fairly good health. But they refused that, and they gave no reason whatsoever for refusing the Russian offer, which was bizarre because Russia is a member of the Security Council. Russia sponsors the ICTY,
mm-hmm.
and they could never have him go to Russia and not send him back. It would be get all these accusations of betraying the whole object of the game.
Yeah.
So, but it was done because Milosevic thought that it was done. That refusal was made because they were going to find out what was really in his blood. And he wrote a letter to the foreign minister 3 days before he died stating that he thought something was going on with him
mm-hmm.
and that they didn't want him to go to Russia because it would be found out.
Mm-hmm.
And then 3 days later, he was dead.
By the way, if someone was taking something, he and his defense team, that would harm him, that'd be the wrong time to be telling everybody, hey, please check me out.
Right. And he had been informed just a week before he wrote the letter by the UN doctor that they'd found a drug called rifampicin in his system. But they had known about that for 3 months, but had only told him just before he died. And that's when he wrote the letter.
Mm-hmm.
And the letter, before it could be acted on, he died or was killed.
Yeah.
And the rifampicin is important because it's an antibiotic for treating tuberculosis, among other things,
mm-hmm.
which he did not have. But the other purpose of it is, or the other effect of it, is it metabolizes other drugs more rapidly in the system. So mm-hmm. it could be used to mask or eliminate something else
mm-hmm.
In the blood.
Yeah.
So
well,
we'll never know.
Yeah, now, this is Chris Black, and he's written an article on this calling for an inquiry. So, Chris, where do you start with this? I mean, it's rather difficult. Here's the Judge Parker is with – he's part of the process there so in a way. Right. I mean, that never should have happened. But now, who could do this? I mean, what do you – would you like international leaders, others to speak up and say we were just not satisfied? How do you get an inquiry?
Yes, that was part of the purpose of publishing the article, because the rules, the prison rules of the ICTY explicitly state that on the death of a prisoner in the UN hands, there should be an inquiry under the laws of the country in which is the host state, in that case the Netherlands. Now that was, under their laws, just a police inquiry. But if the tribunal had been, say, in Britain, it would have meant a coroner's inquiry, an inquest, with public witnesses and cross-examination of witnesses, mm-hmm. and calling of witnesses.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're now dealing with a head of state, and a man who's never been found guilty of anything, who dies in UN hands.
Mm-hmm.
And the only inquiry is an internal one by parties interested in the outcome of the investigation.
Uh-huh.
The ICD doesn't want to say, yes, we killed him.
Mm-hmm. Or mishandled it, or bungled it.
Exactly. So the family wants to know, why did my husband and my father die? How did he die? Why was this trial never completed? In fact, why wasn't the evidence of the defense presented anyway by somebody else to finish the trial and prove that he was, because he proved he was innocent of all the charges. Nobody accepts that.
Mm-hmm. Well, by the way, didn't he get them to back off some of the charges?
Yes, they dropped them.
They were retreating.
Yeah, they were collapsed. They collapsed very early on, and his defense was brilliant, and because they had no case. It was quite clear now it was all made up.
Mm-hmm.
But we called now for an international public inquiry, because he is a head of state. I think the UN and the Security Council, well, certain members on it, should support such an inquiry to find out what happened in that UN prison.
Yes. Incidentally, the UN has a history of being happening to be sort of in and around when heads of states die.
Mm-hmm.
Like in the case of Ms. Patrice Lumumba, which now I'm remembering led to eventually two investigations which showed some criminal hands that hadn't previously been exposed.
Yes. And now we have the investigation to Arafat's death by the French. There's been no investigation, of course, into the murder of the presidents of Rwanda and Burundi in 1994, and the UN's That's right. involved in that, too.
The UN lost the black box.
Or
another word might be hid it.
Yeah.
By the way, Chris, you revealed a detail which I know will prick up the listeners' ears. The Wikipedia produced a document from the man running the prison.
Mm-hmm.
Where Milosevic was held, and he had been passing information to the United States.
Right. Turns out that
how would he be doing that?
He was actually having meetings with the American ambassador in The Hague. Wikipedia published some memos, internal memos from ambassadors' memos or faxes to headquarters, in which they speak about meetings with the commandant of the UN detention center at the ICTY, where the commandant is giving information, conversations he had with Milosevic, phone calls they've listened to between his wife and his son and his lawyers.
It's private information.
Private and privileged information.
And they weren't sharing this with the rest of us.
No, they weren't. And the commandant of the UN, his chain of command is through the UN.
Hmm.
To the president of the ICTY, not to the Americans or any other country. And yet he was having private meetings talking about this prisoner. For what purpose?
Mm-hmm.
What were the Americans telling the commandant of the prison? Why, what were they doing with this information? Were they feeding it then to the prosecutor?
Yes.
What was going on?
No, that, by the way, that alone should make us all say, let's all have an inquiry here and find out what the heck was happening.
Right.
Chris Black, it's great talking to you. We wish you well, and we want to hear from you when you return from your trip to the ICTR.
I'd be glad to talk to you again.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
That's Christopher Black. Very interesting story. We'll try to post that on the Taylor Report site. We will post it. Hey, and remember, CIUT is going to have David Barsamian, the director host of Alternative Radio, Wednesday, March 27, Debates Room, Hart House, 12 noon. Tickets are $30 at U of T. Tickets, U of T ticks dot CIUT.ca, and the proceeds go to CIUT, so there's a very good reason to come to this event. It'll be part of our upcoming membership drive. Phil, you have something.
Yes, tomorrow night, Tuesday, March the 12th, Chavez, The Life of a Revolutionary. It'll be a meeting with speakers at OISE, room 2214. That's 252 Bloor Street West by St. George Street in room 2214. Chavez, The Life of a Revolutionary, Tuesday at 7 p.m.
Yeah, very good. Thank you very much, Phil. You've been listening to Taylor Report. Check us out, taylor-report.com. Write to us, taylor@caut.fm. And Pablo Vivanco, Chris Black, we're very appreciative. Thank you, Terry and Phil, and we'll see you next week.